This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Today would have been Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 89th birthday, but his life, like so many others in the civil rights movement, was cut short. The impact that King, Medgar Evers, and Malcolm X had on the country was so profound, it's hard to believe they were all under 40 when they died. James Baldwin was a close friend to all three men, and he wanted to write a personal account of their lives and successive assassinations. I Am Not Your Negro, a documentary written and directed by Raoul Peck and produced by his brother Hébert Peck, uses the 30 pages Baldwin completed on the project to create a powerful film that journeys through Black history and connects the civil rights movement to the present of Black Lives Matter. You can see the film tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS, but check your local listings. But first, right now, I want to welcome Hébert Peck to the show. Hébert, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
So I want to congratulate you on the many awards this film received, including a nomination for the Academy Award for Best Documentary last year, and the fact that this was a box office hit. Are you surprised that this film seems to be resonating with so many?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say that it's not just Raoul and myself. There's also Rémi Grilletti, who's our partner in this production. But to answer your question, whether we were surprised by the success of the film, is that the question? I think really we were pleased by the success of the film. I think we, from the beginning, we thought Baldwin was an important American, an important writer of probably the second half of the 20th century as an American writer. And so from the beginning, Raoul wanted to bring him back to our lives. So we were very pleased that Baldwin's words resonated again with the American public. And so the first surprise we received from, in terms of the public's reaction, was at the Toronto Film Festival, where we first screened it to the public, and they gave us a standing ovation. So that was really where it all started, I would say.
Now, what makes your film even extra powerful, I think, for the listeners, is you started this project 10 years ago.
Yes, indeed. So Raoul had just finished a film for HBO called Sometimes in April about the Rwandese genocide. And at the time, he felt he wanted to tackle Baldwin. And James Baldwin had been an important part of his life, I think, since he was a young adult. After reading The Fire Next Time, I think that book really changed his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the subsequent decades, as a filmmaker, he didn't tackle Baldwin, but at that time he felt it was time for him to do a film, to do something. He wasn't sure if it was going to be a narrative, he wasn't sure if it was going to be a mixed media piece or even a documentary. So the first thing was to get the rights from the estate. And so when we received the rights from the estates, which we were extremely pleased, because that wasn't a simple thing. We had heard that the estate wasn't always responsive to such requests. Yet within 3 days, Raoul got an answer back from the estate saying, please come to D.C., let's talk. And so we received the rights to James Baldwin's entire body of work, published and unpublished works, private letters, private photographs. And so that meant that two things. We were excited about it, but also for Raoul, that meant he had a lot on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And so during the first 4 years, he was experimenting with different approaches to enter the story. And it wasn't until Gloria Carifa Smart, the head of the Baldwin estate, and also who happens to be James Baldwin's youngest sister. At the time, she was preparing all of Baldwin's documents to hand off to the Schomburg, the New York Public Library. And she, as she was organizing all of his papers, she found these 30 pages. And she handed them to Raoul and said, "Here, Raoul, I think you'll know what to do with this." And so these were 30 pages of a document, basically, that Baldwin had written to his literary agent, telling him and explaining to him about the next book he wanted to write. And those 30 pages were entitled "Remember This House." And so when Raoul got these 30 pages, he... first of all, it was exciting. When you read unpublished work and you see the power of Baldwin's words, and you also understand the context in which he wrote these 30 pages, it was an incredible experience. Now, Baldwin never got to write the book that he wanted to write.
Right.
And so, because he passed away. But Raoul felt that, in fact, he had written this book, and it could be found in all of his body of work, and that his job as a filmmaker was to put it together in a visual way.
Mm-hmm. You're listening.
So that's how it started.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Hébert Pack. He is a producer on the documentary "I Am Not Your Negro." He did this in conjunction with his brother, the writer director Raoul Pack. You know, Hébert, it's interesting that you say that the estate was very responsive when your brother Raoul went to them to talk to them about this project. But isn't it true that in the early stages of this project, that it was almost impossible to convince anybody about the film? How did Raoul and you and the other people involved in this project get people to come around to make sure that "I Am Not Your Negro" went from idea to film?
Jonathan, that we're going to need more than an hour,
which we do not have.
But you are correct. You are correct. And there was some interest. Interest because of Raoul's body of work, first of all. And so it wasn't, we had an international co-production as a result. But early on, Independent Lens and PBS were very interested in the subject and very interested in seeing what could come from this project. And so they became a partner. And that was very insightful and very helpful to us. And then you're right. Generally, for a topic like this, when you go to the usual suspects in terms of funding for independent films in the U.S., often you're asked, "Well, we understand your position, but you need to." To include in your topic the other side, and for a film on Baldwin to even be told that, you realize that, well, they're probably not really serious about funding this film.
Right. There is no, given Baldwin's subject matter and the power behind the subject matter, the idea that you would bring in the other side, I can only imagine, was, dare say, insulting.
Yes, but you just go forward. So Raoul had several things that he was interested in doing, and so that those things really shape our progress forward. One was that he did not want to have any a typical documentary where you would have talking heads sort of couching and explaining what was happening in the documentary, or even explaining Baldwin's point of view or Baldwin himself. And he also wanted this to be a pure Baldwin experience, in that we as the viewer should experience the film from Baldwin's perspective. And thirdly, he wanted it to, for the film, to only include include Baldwin's own words, whether he was at a conference he was speaking, or whether it was portions of things he said in his body of work in terms of his literature. And so these three things also meant that you needed to have complete control of the project from beginning to end. And so from the beginning, we realized that then the film would have to be produced through Velvet Film, Raoul's company.
Mm-hmm.
And but as any independent filmmaker will tell you, if and when you take that route, then it's going to take you a long time to raise funds and to go forward. But that's how Raoul mm-hmm. works. And for a subject like Baldwin, there was no other choice.
You know, Hébert, I should have mentioned earlier that I did an event in Washington after a screening of I Am Not Your Negro with your brother, Raoul. And having seen the film, which if you have not seen it, you really should tune in tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern Time on PBS to see the movie. The thing that I found, I mean, it's a powerful film, but what I found most powerful was what seemed to be a conversation going on between the past and the present, where you can hear Baldwin's words, which you know are coming from decades earlier, as scenes of present-day Times Square, present-day New York City flash by. Was that a conscious effort on the part of Raoul, on the part of the team, to show, in a sense, the timelessness of Baldwin's ideas?
Yes, it was. And as Baldwin says in the film and in his work, you know, history is not the past. History is the present. And so we, from the beginning, Raoul was interested in showing that that timeline was really not too far ago. It really was part of the present, part of our current existence, and part of our history. So what you experience basically is a result of that of his filmmaking, making sure that we as a viewer could see or could feel that there was really there was no difference between the past and the present. Not to say that things have not improved. If things had not improved, we couldn't even make a film like this. But to say that we still have a long way to go. And the central part of this is really Baldwin himself, who, through his words, through his ability to describe our experience as Americans, was able to write in such a powerful and clear language that when you see the film, or when you read his work, his essays especially, you think that he wrote that stuff this morning.
Right.
And that's really one of the things that makes him such an incredible writer, is that he was almost prescient, right? That he could write 50 years ago and still make us feel as if he just wrote it this morning.
Hébert, when we have to go to a break now, but when we come back, what also adds to the power of I Am Not Your Negro is the actor Samuel L. Jackson. And we'll talk about his role in this film when we come back. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Hébert Peck about the Oscar-nominated documentary I Am Not Your Negro, which he produced with his brother, director Raoul Peck. Later on in the show, journalist Ted Conover with his latest article for the Smithsonian Magazine called The Strike That Brought MLK to Memphis. And Sebastian Lelio, who wrote and directed the film A Fantastic Woman, along with actress Daniela Vega, who stars in it. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. I Am Not Your Negro is a documentary, Oscar-nominated documentary, by writer-director Raoul Peck and his producer brother, Hébert Peck, who is on the line talking with me and with us about the documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, which is premiering tonight, airing tonight on PBS locally at 9 p.m. But be sure to check your local listings if you are listening outside of New York City, the New York area. Hey, Baird, again, thank you for being here. When I teased going into the break, I talked about Samuel L. Jackson and his role in the documentary. Talk about Samuel L. Jackson as the narrator.
So in the process, at some point, most of Raoul's work has a narrator. He uses a voiceover. And so for this, he wanted to use a voiceover, which also was a gamble in that James Baldwin has a very distinctive voice, and you hear his voice. It's very unique and very powerful. And so we had to figure out who the voiceover was. But fairly early in our selection process, Samuel Jackson was always on top of the list. Samuel Jackson has a he's a trained theater actor. He has clout in the black community. Mm-hmm. He is very clear in what he says and what he means. So we knew that he was an important person person for the film because. He would be perfect. Mm. But of course, he would have to accept to be part of the film. And so by the time we were at our rough cut stage, probably closer to the fine cut stage, we were able to contact his folks and see if he was interested.
How long did it take Samuel L. Jackson to say yes?
From what we understand, once we sent him the rough cut, he was on board.
You know, I'm glad you said in talking about Samuel L. Jackson and his standing in the black community, I wrote down here on a piece of paper that Samuel L. Jackson has an authority within the black community where when you hear Samuel L. Jackson, and this is the thing, he's not just narrating, he is speaking James Baldwin's words. And so you combine the power of the words with the power of Samuel L. Jackson's voice, and you end up having a pretty incredible experience.
Absolutely. And the directions that Raoul gave Sam, which were very limited directions just because of the actor he is, the trained actor that he is, the professional that he is, he said, you know, he was not looking for someone to mimic James Baldwin's voice. He wasn't looking for someone to sort of be outside of being the outside and reciting a text. He wanted him to really be that person. So he gave him the text. And of course, as a trained actor, Sam just basically did what any stage actor would do, is just really make that text his. And so that from that point on, whatever he did, whatever he said, whatever he did not say, right, the beats, the pauses, the everything that came out of him was powerful, was gold for us in the industry, we would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, and also this is a person who's very familiar with James Baldwin. So it was incredible to have him on the team, but it was also incredible. It was incredible to have an actor of his ability, because you have also to be quite selfless to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know, and people may know, but in the industry, it's very hard if you're an A-lister who has a certain image to be able to deliver something that really is not your typical way that you're seen as an A-lister, right, as an actor, but it shows the range that you have when you are able to really completely disappear into this role.
Right.
And that's what makes him such an incredible actor.
So, Hébert, we, meaning America, the United States, have just gone through probably the most incredible 5 days in terms of race relations, in terms of who we are as a country, the United States, what we stand for. And I want to play a clip of James Baldwin that challenges the very definition of what America stands for. And I want to talk to you about it on the other side.
There are days, this is one of them, when you wonder what your role is in this country and what your future is in it. How precisely you're going to reconcile yourself to your situation here, and how you're going to communicate to the vast, heedless, unthinking, cruel white majority that you are here. I'm terrified at the moral apathy, the death of the heart, which is happening in my country. These people have deluded themselves for so long that they really don't think I'm human. I have basis on their conduct, not on what they say. And this means that they have become, in themselves, moral monsters.
Hébert, those words were spoken decades ago by James Baldwin. And like I said before going to that clip, this past weekend, the words attributed to and backed up by two senators, one Democrat, one Republican, the words uttered by the President of the United States only served to highlight just how present day Baldwin's words are.
Yeah, and how universal they are. I mean, I'm a Haitian American, and so hearing those words coming out of the White House were really, in a sense, quite disgusting. It was words that you don't expect to come from the seat of our government. And when there are so many, and I'm just talking of Haitian Americans or Haitians in general, there are so many Haitians of or people of Haitian descent in the United States who contribute daily to making the country a better country. There are Haitian Americans who served in the military. My brother served in the military, my eldest brother, Jean-Claude. He went to Vietnam. There are Haitian physicians, Haitian teachers, Haitian in the entertainment industry, Haitian, you name it. And so these are American of Haitian descent who are outraged by these statements. They're it's hard to even find word.
Mm-hmm. Hébert, go ahead.
Before I go, Jonathan, I'd like to say also, but this is just, today is just a statement about Haitian, but yesterday it was a statement about women. The day before it was about Mexicans. The day before it was about people of gays. The next day, so it's really turning back to Baldwin. Yeah, that's part of the message that he is saying, is that we are all part of this country, and that unless we are able to realize that we need each other to move forward, to make this country a place that is a better place, a place that's never existed before anywhere else on the globe, unless we understand that, we are not going in the right direction. It's not going to be a good future mm-hmm. for all of us.
Hébert, do you think being an immigrant has given you some insight into American racism?
Well, I think at some level, yes. I live in Haiti. I lived also in the Congo, Zaire, and I lived in France. So to say that America's experience with racism is unique is would be wrong. I've experienced some racism in Europe as well, but what I have learned is that basically that we tend to forget. We always tend to get stuck with our individual fights,
right.
And that sometimes that confuses the larger issue. It's a universal fight. It's all of us that need to fight because we're all affected, whether we realize it or not.
Hébert, you mentioned that you experienced racism in Europe, and for those who remember James Baldwin and know him well, know that he divided his time between Paris and New York, and that his experiences in France were so different from those in America. Didn't that difference inform Baldwin's view, his view about just how racist Americans are or were?
Yeah, and you know what it is that once, I think for him, and he says that all the time, and he says it in the film, in America, he was always fighting for his survival, so that he had no time to do anything else than to watch his back. And going to Europe provided him a level of freedom where he was able to, as he say, take these antennas down that he had to have on every day to survive here. It allowed him to become the writer that really he could be. It allowed him to look at the bigger picture and what was going on in America in a way that he could really do it in a very clear way, because he didn't have these social pressures that were also scary social pressures that could kill him. And now, the reason I'm answering your question like that, I think, Jonathan, is to say we have a problem with race in America. And I think when James Baldwin went to Europe, he was accepted, I think, in a sense, as a the issue with race in France at the time was very different. Mm-hmm. I think their issue with race was with the Algerians, with people from the Maghreb, and so he was not a part of that group, and therefore was kind of overlooked and accepted at some level.
Right.
But that also provided him with an opportunity to be freer as a writer and to talk and look at his country mm-hmm. in a different way.
Do you think, in regards to race, that from the French perspective, he wasn't viewed through a racial lens, that Baldwin, being in France, was seen as an American first?
I agree with that. Yes, you are correct. Yes.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yes, he was seen as an American, and also as a black American that had a culture that was seen in differently in America in terms of the culture of music, the culture of writing, the culture of that. So he was seen much differently.
Mm-hmm. I bring that up because in my first time to Europe, I spent a lot of time in Italy and walking around in Naples. And realizing for the first time that people were not looking at me as a black male walking into their store or walking into their shop, but first viewed me as an American. And it was an incredible experience to this day, just recounting that sends chills down my spine. You know, Hébert, could you talk about James Baldwin's words and the juxtaposition of the images from present-day New York, present-day America, Black Lives Matter, and where we are in the country now?
Well, I think for James Baldwin, James Baldwin was always a person who was able to deconstruct the way America was presented to us, or the general, the average American, so that although he was passionate in his exchanges, and you'll see that in the film, and you could see it on YouTube, there's a lot of clips of James Baldwin, but he always spoke from a position of love, from because he was a humanist, a true humanist in that sense. And so for him, change can only occur if we face the problems that we have as a nation. So when he was writing 50 years ago, what he saw really was a sense that we were reluctant, or for whatever reason, we were not looking or facing why we were the way we were as a nation. And so those things, for the most part, have not really changed at the core. And for him, it was a systematic issue. It was about understanding the system in which we live in. Going forward, 50 years forward, yeah, there hasn't been some significant change in terms of certain structures. I think for James Baldwin also, as he looked at the three men, these three friends of his, he saw that they saw the system as being less complicated than we make it out to be, so that there was no big difference between a very poor white and a poor black, and so that if these two sides were able to see that they were in the same fight, it would be an incredible change would happen a lot faster.
You've been listening to Hébert Peck about the Oscar-nominated documentary I Am Not Your Negro, which he produced with his brother, director Raoul Peck. The film premieres on PBS's Independent Lens today at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I misspoke earlier, but check your local listings. Hébert, thank you so much for being here today.
Jonathan, thank you. And I really like to thank PBS and ITVS for bringing this film to people's living room.
I concur. Coming up, journalist Ted Conover with his latest article for the Smithsonian Magazine called The Strike That Brought MLK to Memphis. And later, former New York Times reporter James Risen describes what it was like being a national security reporter covering the war on terror. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. We'll be right back after a break.